LinuxQuestions.org presents LQ Radio, the number one online radio broadcast focusing on Linux and open source. And now, LQ Radio, open talk about open source.
Hello, and welcome to the fourth in the LQ Radio interview series. Today I have with me Doc Searles. Thanks for joining us, Doc.
Hey, great to be here, guys.
And for those listeners who might not be as familiar with you as some of the other ones, why don't you give us just kind of an introduction of a little history?
Okay, well, I'm a senior editor at Linux Journal, which is, we think of it as the premier Linux magazine. And it's been around since Linux 1.0 in 1994. And we have a worldwide circulation, a little hard to say. My title is senior editor, and my joke about that is that I'm the oldest editor on staff, and that's the qualification. I've been writing it for the magazine in one way or another since about 96, and I've been a senior editor, I guess, since 99.
Oh, coming up 99. On 10 years, huh?
God, it's hard to believe that, but I guess so. I started out working with a Linux Journal spin-off or an abortive spin-off called WebSmith. Phil Hughes, who's our publisher and the guy who created Linux Journal, along with many other things, had the correct idea that the web was a happening thing and that hacking on the web was going to be a happening thing. It's just that we weren't the only ones who had that idea. We're a little late and small to the game, and so we ended up folding all that editorial. You can still search it. If you do a search at the Linux Journal site, for some word string or some keyword combination that's in an old WebSmith piece, you might find it. One is Bulldozer. I had a piece about LDAP, an interview with Craig Burton, who's a really bright guy and was responsible in many ways for Novell's success in the 80s, who alerted me to the deeper meanings of Netscape hiring all the LDAP people from the University of Michigan back when it happened. I guess it was in 96. And how that was had the intended consequence of throwing a monkey wrench into Microsoft's efforts to sort of collapse the whole world into what later became Active Directory in a project that it was at that time, I think, called Cairo. Since then, some Microsoft people have denied that was ever the intent. However, it certainly did prevent it, and LDAP took off, and as we know the rest of that history. So, right. And actually, another fun one was Jabber. I did a lot of reporting on Jabber when Jabber first came along, and I note that in the last couple of days, Google based their new IM system on Jabber, which I think finally establishes XMPP, which is the Jabber protocol, as the web or the net native IM standard. And it's probably going to be a matter of time before AOL and MSNNet and Yahoo and the others don't adopt Jabber. Apple's already done that to some degree with a kind of a sidecar hanging off of iChat, at least as I understand it.
That's one of the topics I had to discuss later.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So anyway, so I work for Linux Journal. That's my day job. I'm also known as one of the four co-authors of a book called The Clutrain Manifesto, which came out in 2000, like January of 2000, just in time. Some people have accused us of causing the dot-com crash. It was kind of a rant against dot-com thinking. You know, a lot of people didn't know that at the time, and that's what it was. Mm-hmm. And it started as a website that four of us just hacked because we felt there's a bunch of stuff that needed to be said that wasn't being said, so we said it, and a lot of people liked it, and then we made it into a book, and then the book sold really well, still sells well. And so there's a bit of notoriety that came with that. And then I'm fairly well known for writing a weblog, uncreatively called Doc Searles Weblog. And that's originally it was the Clutrain weblog. It was going to be a companion for Clutrain. We realized that we missed by a matter of weeks realizing that blogs were going to be a happening thing in the summer of 99 when we were sprinting a marathon to finish the book. And the whole time, Dave Weiner, who's in many ways the father of RSS that we know now, and the syndication format that most of the major publishers use it at this point. Dave was in many ways the father of blogging as well, and he's the guy who basically sat me down and forced me to blog using his software and everything else. And he wanted us to put blogging in that book, and we didn't do it. And then I realized that we ought to do a blog, and we had the Kluge-Train web blog, but I was the only one writing on it. And I realized at that point that blogging was mostly a solitary activity. And so I just renamed it. I didn't name it anything, actually. It just became Doc Searle's weblog, because that's what Dave called it, I think.
Mine's original... Jeremy's weblog, so it's just as unreal.
Yeah, I think that's easier. I hate the blogs that you go to and it's, you know, it's called Razafanasnatch, and you look all through it, and you're trying to find the name of somebody and you don't know. Mm. You know, and I like to point to a name.
Sure.
You know, even if it's, you know, if it's a blog called Darknet, or Our Media, I'd rather point to J.D. Lassica or Mark Canner than to, you know, some brand name, as
right.
it were. So, yeah, I think...
Still using the same original software that you started with, correct? You haven't moved to one of
them? I'm grandfathered into that. As a matter of fact, something I'd like to plug is Dave is on the record as wanting somebody in the Linux community to come in and help them port Manila and Frontier, I think, is what he actually open sourced on the GPL, which is the scripting language that Manila is written in, so that and to work on OPML, the OPML outliner that he's doing, which
right.
is also, if I'm not mistaken, an open source project, and I think it's also in the GPL. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it is.
It was sitting on. So anyway, it's a Manila blog, and it's been, you know, to move it is such a daunting and probably self-defeating exercise, and I really don't want to do that, especially since Dave has been unusually generous all along in providing server space for it and support and the rest of it, and especially since there's a good chance that somebody's going to step up and help move Manila to Linux to be really great for me. If I'd love it if I could write in OPML on Linux and have the thing running on a Linux server, that would be very, very cool.
That'd be nice. And you said he's looking for people to help port it?
Yeah.
Do you know what language it's written in? Just if anyone out there knows.
I don't even know.
Okay.
I have no idea.
I'll find out.
It's in what he needs to port. I think it's in C. I think Manila itself is in C, but Frontier is the scripting language that is used. Anyway, I think at the bottom level something is C, and above that it's Frontier, and that's pretty much it. But one of my disclaimers is that I am not the technical editor of Linux Journal, and I'm not, you know, I love technology, I know a lot, but I came late to this. My expertise, such as it is, was in electronics circa 1965, so I could understand a half-wave rectifier using vacuum tubes, but and pass my general ham license test, and which I never did, by the way, because I never passed the code test. I flunked it 3 times by missing a space the last 2 times because my handwriting is so bad.
Really?
But my joke about it is the only code I know is Morse. That's how old I am. I love being an older guy participating in the community, but I'm not, I know just enough to be dangerous, and I just destroy everything. That's one of the problems I have with my Linux box. I don't know what I've done that I can undo now, and sometimes I'll bring it limping back to the lug or some other place, asking somebody to lay hands on it and make it right again.
Sure. So I forget if it was in Boston or last year in San Francisco, one of the two, I had run into you at the Linux Journal booth, and you were having someone from Novell install NDL, Novell Desktop Linux?
I think it's NLD, I don't know what the acronym is, but it's the Novell Linux Desktop.
Okay, Novell Linux Desktop.
Yeah.
Is that still what you have on there?
In fact, they put a little red tag on it, like the Pentium M thing, and like the IBM ThinkPad thing, and unfortunately, the Microsoft thing on the bottom that they're required to put on there.
Right.
Novell Linux Desktop, it's called.
Novell Linux Desktop. Okay. You still have that on there?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm using.
And do you
I had Fedora on before that. No, I had two generations of SUSE on there before that, and originally it had Fedora. But there was a problem with Fedora and FireWire, I think. I was attempting to run some of the Max FireWire drives off of it so I could swap files that way. And which
Fedora pulls FireWire right out of it.
You know, one of the things I realized is, why am I even doing this? Because the same drives have USB on them, so it was kind of a stupid thing. But there were other problems, too. It had a real problem at the Fedora. This is like whatever Fedora was out at Linux World 2 Januaries ago.
This would have been January. Core 2, right?
Yeah, I think it was. It wasn't around. It hadn't been Fedora for that long, even. It was in January of 2004.
Okay.
So that's when the machine dates from, is January 2004. And it's an Emperor Linux box that comes from Emperor, which does a really nice job of, you know, customizing your choice of Linux on your favorite desktop, and they support it and the rest of it. And while their support is very good, it's really an expert-level support. I mean, it's really, their customers are scientists and sysadmins and you know, people who use these things in, you know, to make a technical living, and I'm not one of those. I'm more of a, you know, newbie user type.
I would have thought it'd be the other way around. I'd figure a sysadmin would install Linux himself.
Well, they might, but the, you know, I think it's a matter of you've got a you know, you work for an employer and they need to buy from a vendor, and you know, rather than have you hack up something they've got, if you buy it from a vendor that supports it, they like that kind of thing. So and a lot of their customers actually are just academics, as I recall, scientists and academic types. There's no shortage of those,
right?
And they seem to make a good business. And Lincoln Durie himself, the founder of the company, the guy who runs the company, is a PhD academic, and you know, loves the operating system and knows what he's doing.
Right.
And always does miraculous things when I bring, you know, when I'm at a Linux World and, you know, haul the machine over to them and say, fix it. They do that. But then, you know, he'll usually, you know, tell me, well, you know, SU to root and then do these 45 things, and I'm lost. Mm-hmm. So, and with Novell, the reason I went all over maybe you remember this, I went all over the show looking at different distros, and but I ended up going with Novell because they're, you know, they're drinking their own Kool-Aid, you know, they've made a commitment to turn the whole company's the desktops into Linux desktops and to use the stuff, and they're troubleshooting it on the spot, and they had some nice hacks that I really like too, like the Robert Love, who's written a lot for the Linux Journal over the years, had has a cool little utility called NetApplet that. Have you guys seen that? You know that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does Wi-Fi finding, basically.
Right.
And it's pretty nice. You can choose your ports, and you can look at the signal strengths of different hotspots and move back and forth between them. It's more feature-rich than what we see, for example, on the Mac, which is a very simple and easy and straightforward UI about that, but it doesn't give you things like signal strength, and it doesn't let you, you know, give you the technical flexibility that NetApplet
does. Right, it's pretty dumbed down on the Mac.
It is really tight. Yeah, that's one of the problems with the Mac, is that it's extra dumbed down in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, even things like with podcasting, there was something I was looking at with that where in order to, maybe it was, oh, I know what it was. It's with the iMovie. If you go to save a movie and you want to say, look, I want to save it at this resolution in MPEG-4, it isn't like that. It's like, do you want, you know, it wants you to name your application, you know, what you're going to do with it when you're done with it, and it'll kind of figure out what your ideal thing for that is, and I don't like that.
Too smart for its own good sometimes.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's like the all automatic digital camera. I'm a photographer, so I want a lot of control over f-stops and shutter speeds and things like that. And
sure.
You know, so that's, you know, that... if I were as expert at operating Linux as I am at photography, we would have a problem, but I'm not, so there we are.
The one thing I kind of never understood about the Linux, Novell Linux desktop is, what's their distinction between that and then SUSE?
I don't know. I mean, I think it sits on SUSE. Yast is still there, which is SUSE's sort of, you know, utility management environment. You want to install something or other, you go through Yast, and Yast is still there, but so also is a bunch of utilities that they do. So okay. I think it's kind of like, and it probably isn't like GNOME and KDE because you can't run them both at the same time.
Because now it seems like they have Novell, and then they have SUSE Enterprise, which is a SLES product, and then they have SUSE Pro, and they have OpenSUSE. So it seems like they have so many products that it's...
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I only know... I mean, my only hands-on is with this desktop, and I'm not even sure which one it is. I mean, it's. I keep running a system update thing, which is their utility, by the way. And okay. It seems to do a good job. I mean, it says you need these 15 things, and it installs them, and there you are. And it seems to be pretty straightforward.
And there's no charge for that like there is with RHN from Red Hat?
I don't know. Maybe there is, and I don't know it. I don't think so. Okay. I don't think so. I think that's a no-charge thing, but I don't know. It's one of the nice things about being on the radio. You just say, well, I don't know. And, you know, there it is. Yeah.
So we kind of ran each other at OSCON, too. What did you think of OSCON this year?
I like OSCON. I actually like all of O'Reilly's events. The venue was weird because they've always done it in a hotel, and essentially OSCON outgrew a hotel-sized venue, so they had to put it in the Oregon Convention Center, I think it was called, and it was, you know, it was too big. It's like when I remember when I went to see the NCAA basketball finals inside the old King Dome in Seattle, and the King Dome was big enough for it sat 70,000 people and had a football field in the middle of it, and for basketball, they just basically put this set of seats at one end of it, and when you looked up, there was this like vast dark cavern off to one side, and
right.
And that's sort of the feeling that I had there. There was a just a, you know, that it was almost too big, but I got used to it after a while, and it was I liked it. I think it's been more of a business show over the last several years, but it hasn't lost its hacker flavor either. So, and there were plenty of breakout sessions for plenty of technical subjects, and a lot of speakers that were really good. They selected speakers pretty carefully, and they try to cover new ground. And I like the guy that had the origami, you know, open source origami.
That was crazy.
Radical.
Yeah,
that was amazing. Just looking at what that guy does anyway. But the fact that he's using Linux and had made a tie into open source with that was pretty remarkable. I think it was the last one before that, a year ago, that Paul Graham spoke about hackers and painters, which was also a brilliant talk. Mm. It's so
he
I think
was
they
good
do
this year too.
I they know. Do a really good job, and they keep up. They're about the about the only guys who do a really good job of keeping up on the website, so you can get on the website and see what's going on. The failures in this case were ones of scaling. The Wi-Fi didn't scale. They had a lot of problems with it. Yeah, and that was the first time I've seen that level of kind of continuous catastrophic failure of the Wi-Fi at an O'Reilly event. I'm used to it at other events because generally when you're dealing with a bad combination of variables, you've got a hotel that doesn't know what's going on and subcontracts out all the connectivity to some company that doesn't know what's going on either, and is only used to delivering paid service, say, to transients that are staying in the hotel. And when they do provide Wi-Fi for conference attendees, it's never high demand, you know, until it's one of the conferences that I go to, and all of a sudden it's high demand and things break down. But O'Reilly's always done a pretty good job of managing all that themselves. But they literally had some glitch that they just took them a long time to shake out.
It was just a growing pain that they didn't. It seemed like more like a capacity issue than anything, because it was fine not at the keynotes, and when everyone wasn't all online at once, it seemed to be okay. But in the morning,
somebody told me, and I forget the term that they used, but there was some programmatic error involving a loop somewhere. So while the traffic did trigger that, it wasn't really a bandwidth issue, that they had sufficient bandwidth to handle the show, and they wanted to make sure of that, but it was some other issue that a lot of activity triggered. And so that's what the problem was, and it took them until nearly the end of the show to work it out. And so it made reporting on it on the fly really hard. It made following what was going on or checking on stuff really hard. Yeah.
Almost impossible at times.
Yeah, in fact, I went ahead and I think one of the times I just paid the, I just got on the other network that was provided by the convention center and just, you know, went ahead and paid $11 or whatever it was for the day. It was worth it to be able to get onto that and do something with it.
Right.
And it just flipped back and forth between whoever had the best signal, and I'd see if something was going on with the O'Reilly network. But that was the one major failing there, and it was down a lot of the time. Those things always seem like you're down more time than they really are, you know, but
yeah,
it really
true.
Was a... Well, it was enough to really, you know, mar the experience, I think.
Yeah, definitely. I was at GnomeDex probably about a month and a half ago, and they had fairly similar problems, that the conference was great and everything was fantastic, except the network was pretty much continually down almost the whole time.
I don't know if there's a really good way to deal with that, unless you just somehow bring in all your own stuff. The big problem with Wi-Fi right now is that it's, you know, free Wi-Fi is really the exception rather than the rule. It ought to be the rule. It should be like public toilets and public streetlights and things like that. A civic grace provided by the city or the convention center or whatever else happens to be. It would be so much easier if they didn't have to put you through the splash screens and the authentication and all the rest of it. If they, you know, basically firewalled it off the best they could between the users and whatever administrates it and the net. But they don't do that. They in almost every case, there's some company that exists to run the whole pay system, and that it's always, you know, outsourcing hell. It's just, there's no, I mean, I noticed even that Philadelphia is, you know, Philadelphia is not doing its own free Wi-Fi. They're jobbing it out to, they're taking bids. They're taking bids from Earthlink and a bunch of other companies. And,
I didn't know that. I thought they were doing it.
Yeah,
themselves.
I just saw something about that the other day, and maybe I'm wrong about it, but I'm pretty sure that they're taking bids on it. And that kind of makes me cringe. It would be so much better if they went to the local hackers, at least in New York City. I think they're going to NYC Wireless, which are the guys that wired up the city parks. There's a Venn diagram that shows extreme overlap between them and the local logs. And these are, I mean, like the Terry, I forget his last name right now, but he invented Debian Pebble, which is his variant of Debian that was meant for use on Wi-Fi hotspots. And that's what they used for the NYC wireless hotspots at City Hall Park and Bryant Park in New York City. I did a lot of, one of the most fun research projects I did was for Linux Journal was, I think, in the summer and fall of 2003. And it was on your NYC wireless and a lot of the really cool stuff that was happening in New York City at that time. And in that environment, there were an awful lot of people putting out what I think of as just, actually, Nicholas Negroponte called it, flower boxes. You know, that it's when you provide free Wi-Fi to your neighborhood or to the area around your home or to the street outside for the same reason as you put flower boxes on your window. and on your windowsill. And that's pretty much the situation we had in New York City at that time. And I remember sitting in the back of a cab, riding around New York, just pausing it. Every time the cab would stop at a traffic light, I'd see 30 different hot spots, and I'd jump on one of them and pull down some email and file a story or some other thing like that, and then stop at another light, and I'd do the same at another place. It was nice. The air was that thick with them. Well, now a lot more of them are wept, and a lot more of them are inaccessible. There's still plenty, but it's probably, at that time it was about half of them were open, and now probably it's maybe one in five. And then we have these stories coming out of the South, especially. I don't know why it's there, but there was one in Florida, another one in North Carolina. A guy in Florida was arrested for using somebody's Wi-Fi and stealing their packets. And I mean, it's like a felony thing or some crazy thing like that. It's just really that's sad insane. And awful. And there was nobody presenting the opposite point of view. Like, wait a minute, the user left it open. A and B, that's not necessarily a bad thing. But that's not the way the story was played. Some friends in North Carolina, where I used to live and still have many friends and relatives and contacts, sent me a story from WTVD Channel 11 there, which is the ABC affiliate. Used to be CBS when I lived there, which is this long story about you may be in danger of Wi-Fi theft. Who knows? Could be lurking outside your house doing things with your Wi-Fi, and there was no other point of view. It was nothing else was presented.
Right.
It was remarkable.
That's pretty typical, I think, in most media outlets. They spin it how they want to spin it.
But they're looking for sensational bullshit. And
right.
That was a good one. But I feel like a lot of damage was done there. And there's one of the fights that I want to fight is not just on behalf of Linux and open source, but in behalf of understanding the net as a place for free culture and free markets and where freedom of enterprise and activity of any kind is really the basis of it, rather than some minor side effect provided at the behest of the phone companies and the cable companies. But unfortunately, that's the way the FCC sees it, and that's the way Congress sees it, and that's the way the telcos and the cable companies see it. And they're, even with fiber, they're building fiber asymmetrically. I was talking to Dan Bricklin yesterday. Dan is he's the co-inventor of the spreadsheet, and he lives in Boston, where they're providing fiber to the home, and he's getting 15 megs down, and he's getting 3 megs up. But why make it asymmetrical? Why do that? You don't need to do that.
No, they definitely don't.
But and especially when you look at it in terms of people, in terms of free marketplaces where people can set up a private enterprise out of their homes. Why should anybody be able to serve up whatever they want, or go into business any way they want, or put up their family photos, or serve up video any way they want? Well, it's because these guys want, they can't imagine a marketplace in which consumers can also be producers. But that's exactly how we got Linux, and that's exactly how we got open source, and that's what the web is doing here, what the net is doing here.
Yeah.
So,
and that's kind of on the topic of Clutrain, which I was going to say before, for those listeners who haven't read Clutrain, I would definitely recommend picking it up. It's a book that I'm actually probably going to end up buying about 20 copies and giving it away at one of the places I work, just because I think, it's a web company, and I think it's that good and that important to read.
Thanks.
Definitely pick up a copy.
It's one of the reasons it still sells after all these years. I'm kind of amazed, because we wrote that really 6 years ago. And
if you think of how much the internet's changed in 6 years, it's insane.
It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing. But one of the things that we tried to do is just lay out some verities that were durable in a way. A lot of it was just ranting, but but a lot of it the main chapter that I co-wrote, which is called Markets or Conversations, and tries to unpack the first thesis of the manifesto, which is that same three words, was really an attempt to bring us back to a characterization of markets that we had for millennia before the Industrial Revolution. Markets as public places where we can do business and make culture, and where buyers and sellers meet and prices are discovered inside of a conversation, and to get away from thinking about markets as demographics or target audiences or regions or any of the other abstractions that we've been using, and or even bulls and bears and invisible hands and forces and synonyms for demand and other things like that, and bring us back to an original understanding of markets where anybody could participate and anybody could bring value and anybody could change the world. And we felt that what happened with so what happened in the dot-com period was that this amazing new environment was delivered to the world, and not only the old businesses, but a lot of the new businesses that came along said, "Oh, great! It's a revolution in the supply side. You know, we can create malls. We can do advertising. Anybody can publish anything." And it was all about supply, and let's create a mall that's a kind of a walled garden. And it was all about the supply side.
Right. Same walls, different delivery, basically.
Yeah. It was just we'll just find a way to reintermediate a distribution system here. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was that we felt the Kluterian co-authors that it was really a far more profound revolution on the demand side, because the demand side now had a say in markets. Chris Locke, who's the who wrote this line, if there's one clue to get this year, it's this one: that we are not seats or eyeballs or end users or consumers. We're human beings, and our reach exceeds your grasp. Deal with it. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a what Walt Whitman called a barbaric yawp. Chris Leiden, who has a radio show that's also a podcast called Open Source Radio, and who's an NPR veteran and a New York Times reporter veteran, and also a politician in Boston, likes to go back to Whitman and Emerson and Thoreau and those guys and draw a lineage that goes from them to what we're trying to do on the web now. And there's I happen to love Walt Whitman's poetry, and there's a line where Whitman says, the spotted hawk swoops to accuse me. He complains of my gab and my loitering. I too am wild and free. I too am untranslatable. I sound my barbaric yawp across the roofs of the world. And that's kind of what Chris did, really, with that particular passage in Kluterian. And when he shared it with the rest of us, it was really galvanizing. And it was only later that Jakob Nielsen, who does the useit.com, he's kind of a usability site, he's kind of a usability guru, he and I were on a TV show together as a panel. We were both panelists, and afterwards we were having coffee, and he said, "Well, you know what you guys did with Kluterian? You were all marketing guys who defected from marketing and went over to side with markets." And I hadn't thought about that before, but if you look at the voice that Kluterian has written in, that's really it. It kind of even shifts from one voice to another, where we're speaking in some ways as marketers, but much more directly as users or as customers or as fully empowered human beings in an open marketplace, mm-hmm. who have the power to tell the old big suppliers where the hell to get off, and right. and that we can, you know, we don't just have the power to kick tires now, but we really have the power to produce whatever we want as well. You know, that your old advertising assumptions that you can hold us still while you assault us with advertising and treat us as eyeballs and seats and these other abstractions is just obsolete and wrong.
Well, it's
it and yet 6 years later, it's still going on.
Yeah,
sorry,
it amazes me that so many companies still, even now, just completely don't understand how, you know, the web has changed things, and they basically just use TV advertising and put it online and don't realize really how different the medium is.
Yeah, that's true, and to some degree that's to be expected because they know TV advertising and they know radio advertising. I
would have thought it would be expected at some point, but I would have thought it would have been expected at some point. But you think at this day and age, they should start to learn at least.
Well, they are. Some of them are learning, and they're not the usual suspects, though. I mean, what's happened is that a lot of people who weren't in the advertising business before suddenly are. The worst of them are spammers, just outright spammers, and right. The second worst of them are the blog spammers that make what we call splogs. I had a long piece of my weblog about that today. It was going to go in an IT garage, and I really would have wanted to put it in Linux Journal, but there was a bunch of conversation around it, and I felt I needed to get it up right away, so I put it up on my blog. It's had quite a bit of notice, but it's but basically I called blog spam a cancer on what I call the live web, which is what we're on now. This is the live web. It's not the static web. It changes. The static web is what Google was built to crawl in the first place, and the live web is the one that keeps changing with RSS notifications, essentially. It's the syndicated web, and it's the one where anybody can publish and anybody can subscribe to anybody or anything, and that's a radically different place, and that's one where the second worst of the species are polluting right now. They're they're using scripting of some kind or another to produce fake blogs by the zillions, and some of them are Blogspot, and some of them are on hosting sites and using WordPress or movable type, and they're about diseases and they're about travel and they're about all kinds of topics, and they also scrape editorial from other blogs around the web and put them in there. And if you look at the blog search engines, BlogPulse and Technorati and Feedster and PubSub, which are doing the pioneering work, by the way, right now. I'm on the Technorati board of advisors. Technorati was born during a story that Dave Sifri and I were writing for Linux Journal about blogs, and he needed to create a research tool, and Technorati was born. That. And yeah, that's what happened. That's where Technorati came from. It came from a Linux Journal story. There awesome. Was a Dave had a Penguin Computing had loaned us a box that sat in Dave's basement and went out through a DSL line. And Dave created this thing and called me up on the phone and said, "Take a look at this." It was about 1 a.m. And I looked at that and I said, "Holy shit, that's amazing." As far as I'm concerned, it changed my life at that moment, and I think a lot of others came along as well around the same time frame doing similar stuff.
It really is some cool stuff.
It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, go ahead.
Anyway, the thing is that in respect to your, that the people we all know that can't help but think of advertising in old-fashioned terms. While the old-fashioned terms are so well understood and have been around for 70 or 80 years, and there are plenty of media selling advertising on those things, and plenty of media on, even on blogs and so forth, that are still selling essentially space advertising. Nothing wrong with that. That's fine. I talked for a long time to Henry Copeland yesterday, who does blog ads, and a very honorable guy and very honorable advertising placement system, and he educated me a great deal about how blog spam works and how Google's, through no particular fault of Google's, I should add, but because so many people are using Google's AdSense, what these spam blogs are doing is inserting themselves in the middle of the click streams that are flowing around the blogs in order to suck up AdSense money. Right. And I've heard since then from Google that they are absolutely they are at work on it and trying to fix it. They have no interest in having that flourish, even though they do make money on it. I mean, they click and they make money, and the advertiser makes money. But it's a real issue. And if you're an advertiser and you look in that area, and oh my God, it's a mess. I mean, it really is a mess. It's very hard to see what the right thing to do is even if you go through somebody like Google with AdSense, and it's very different. I mean, AdSense, it's a pay-per-click model. There's no display ads, and you don't know where it's going to go. There's an auction system, and you kind of bid up a word or some combination of words, I guess. It's not something we've seen before. But the interesting thing is that there are many, many more. If you look at the total population of advertisers now, in many ways, that the AdSense advertisers are the kind of guys that you used to advertise on, say, Yellow Pages, or small display ads in the local newspaper.
They've definitely lowered the bar down way low to people that would have never considered advertising.
Absolutely, and it's a wonderful thing for those guys. And
yeah.
And it's a good money maker for some of the bloggers. I mean, there's some guys, I was told today, yesterday, by somebody that my blog, which has, it's not that it has a great deal of traffic, and maybe had 3,000 or 4,000 reads today, maybe 5,000, but which is about 1/3 /dot, maybe smaller than that. I have no idea, but there's some that claim hundreds of thousands a day. I don't know, but. But it's not a high traffic site, but it's a high respect site. It has a Google page rank of 8, which you can't discover unless you look at it with a Google toolbar, which runs only on IE on Windows. I gave Google some shit a few weeks ago about being what I call a Windows company.
Well, it runs in Firefox now.
It does. Oh, it runs in Firefox. I can get that for Firefox.
The Google toolbar.
I have no idea.
Yeah, actually, it was funny. They released it. Chris, right when you, I, and Chris DeBona were having that discussion, released
that. That's right. You and I were having that with him. And I said they're a Windows company, and you said, yeah.
Yeah.
And Chris jumped in and said, wait a minute. And to just show what a good guy Chris is, it's his signature on this Google O'Reilly Communicator of the Open Source Communicator of the Year award that I was given after I said that. So that was... That was nice on his part. They're definitely a gracious company, but they're a bit of a fortress right now. You and I, of course, are in total agreement on this. I think that they ought to do like Firefox and come out with this on 3 platforms at once and
yes.
That kind of stuff. And they should make a diligent and public effort to move, say, Picasa to Mac and to Linux. And I think it's absolutely essential to support Linux as a desktop environment, and to have more than just a 2 desktop competition going on out there. I think it's really essential, especially outside the U.S. It's in the part of the world that can't afford a Macintosh as an alternative to Windows.
Right.
That wants to go downscale, not upscale from Windows. That Linux is absolutely essential. And
it's kind of interesting. We've almost in succession hit every topic I've had written down almost in order before I've even mentioned them. Because the last thing
I feel like I've hugged the floor too, so I don't know if
it's what we want. They don't want to hear me. They hear me on the podcast all the time. So
yeah, well, I should be doing more podcasts. What I've discovered is that I do best in a dialogue like this, even though I feel like I'm a little bit. Not so much downbeat, but just tired on this one. I was up a lot of the night last night with these allergies, and in fact, I wrote that long post and another post because I couldn't sleep. So I've been a little less than lively today. Usually, I like to joke around more than I've done.
I will have to have you on again.
Oh yeah, well my pleasure. So are there any stones we've left unturned?
There's still a couple things if you got a little time.
No, sure, go for it.
So what do you think of podcasting now that you've been doing it for a little while?
Well, probably nothing different than I thought about it before I was podcasting for a little while. I think it's a load of fun. I think I'm an old radio guy. It's funny this is a story I haven't told anywhere. I don't think when I met the woman who's now my wife, and we were clearly on our way to getting married. We were sitting in the back of a 747. She was a very heavy traveler, and I was still new to it, and we were still a little bit new to each other, and we were kind of going over our pasts and what we'd done, and she'd been in retailing, she'd been in a fashion magazine, a fashion business, not the fashion magazine. She made sweaters, millions of them sold around the world, and was a very successful and smart business person, which I never was, and I'd had a zillion different kinds of jobs, and I was going over what I did here and then, I'd sold ice cream from an ice cream truck. I was I operated a stereo store, and I was a moving man, and I did all kinds of crap. But I worked in academic parapsychology for a while, and a thing hanging off the side of Duke University, and I worked in radio. I worked in radio for a few years, and I did magazine and newspaper writing in there as well. This is all back in the 70s, and then we started this advertising agency that did pretty well and ended up doing pretty well in Silicon Valley, and a PR agency spun off of that, and then I did marketing off of that. Then I got back into Phil Hughes at Linux Journal actually saved me and got me back into editorial full time. But
kind
somewhere in
the gamut there,
my wife stopped me. Yeah, she said, can you rewind that to when was it that you gave up on radio? And I said, well, I was here. I had worked for this radio station. I did this character on the radio, a kind of joke character called Dr. Dave. I didn't even have – my real name's David, and somebody else had given me the name Dr. Dave. And I started this business with another guy named David, and so – He insisted on using the name David, and so I then became Dr. Dave, and so Doc is a fossil remnant of that, as a nickname. But anyway, she said, so why did you quit, and what was going on with that, and she said, well, that's when you sold out. It just shocked me. She said, what do you mean sold out? I said, well, that's what you wanted to do. You wanted to be in radio. You're a radio guy, and you sold out. You quit. You went on and did something else. She said, I'm not blaming you. You had to, at that time, I had two small children and I had no savings and I really needed to make money and I had some opportunities showed up and some, people more organized than myself wanted to start a company with me and they respected my writing and my work and the rest of it. But radio fell out and I quit doing radio then. And now I can do it again. I may not do it very much or anything like that, but it feels really cool to me to be sitting at my desk right now with a mixer, with a board that looks a little bit like an old Gates Yard board at a mono FM station circa 1972. It has that feel to it, and I've got this broadcast looking mic, the same one that Tony Stidler Denison uses on the Roadhouse podcast. Tony's a writer for Linux Journal as well, and an alpha hacker of the first order, and a really good guy. And he's written for a lot of people over the years. And now he's got this great podcast of nothing but what he calls the finest blues you've never heard. And
oh, I saw that.
Oh, it's a rockin' podcast. And so anyway, I bought this mixer and this mic from him, and I've got this mic hanging over my desk, and my desk therefore looks like a studio, and it feels like a studio. And when I sit down at my desk in the morning, even if I'm not doing anything with it, the microphone calls. It's there. It is. That's what I'm talking over right now. It's much better than talking over a phone. I've got headphones on. I've got a microphone in front of me, and there's something that for me is kind of a natural habitat. There's a part of me that's sort of like if you've ever been a pilot, or if you've ever been a surfer, or if you've ever been a skateboarder. It doesn't even matter what it is. You put that gear in front of you, a skier, and that suddenly you feel at home with it. And that's really cool. I mean, I listen back to myself and I think, oh my God, I've got terrible habits. I'm saying all the time. I forget to speak across the mic, so I'm not popping my P's and stuff like that. But that's part of the charm of podcasting as well. Podcasting is not professional. It's by nature. It's something that anybody can do. I just love that anybody can sit down with a laptop, for that matter, any laptop that's got a microphone in it, and make a podcast.
So what microphone do you use?
What's that?
What
mic? It says MXL on it. And I know it was made in China, and that's all I know about it. I think the mixer, the mic, and the boom together came to about $200.
That's not bad.
Yeah, I just know it looks cool. It sounds pretty good. It sounds pretty good.
Yeah, it doesn't sound bad.
I was really impressed when I listened to it on the first few podcasts that I recorded, that it sounded as good as it did. What I really want to do is get some kind of get up where I can walk around with a portable unit of some kind, maybe one of those Marantz deals that records directly onto a onto, you know, a flash memory, and in, you know, 44.1 digital stereo or something like that, and right. has where I could plug a couple of really good lavalier mics in and do an interview with somebody at a place like OSCON. I'd love to be able to do that, and
I
haven't made the capital outlay yet. It's that's what I really love to do, though. That would be a cool thing.
Yeah, definitely. But, well, that's one thing I liked is when we started this podcast and the show in general. You know, we started really cheap, just a crap mic and no mixer and just a preamp. And just one thing, as you like it more, you'll just invest more and more. And we got a decent mic and a mixer, and we even got a noise gate now and some other stuff. And it's just fun to build and put together a studio. And
well, that's the thing. I want to experiment around with this a bit. This particular mixer I'm using is I saw it for sale for $49.95 the other day on one of the websites that you know that I went to. It's called a Eurorack.
Behringer.
I guess that's who it is. The Eurorack UB802. It's one a lot of people use, and it sounds great. You know, it's got no noise that I can detect, and it's pretty straightforward. You can plug two mics into it. It's fairly lightweight. Does the job. I'm sure it's, you know, I'll find its limitations pretty soon and the rest of it. We're building a new house next door, and I want my office to be more of a real studio, and I want to set that up more conscientiously than I have this one. This is definitely very makeshift. It's a small back bedroom in a house with a couple of utility tables set up to work like desks, and a bunch of laptops and printers and crap scattered around on them, and it looks like a mess. And I want to have something that's clean and cool at the new place.
Yeah.
So that's the, you know, and I'd like to experiment enough before we go over there that I can get the right stuff. And,
Doug, you know, K from IT Conversations has a page up with his exact setup, and he's just got an awesome setup over there. I'd like to do something like that, but.
Yeah, and actually Doug advised me. We're probably going to be using Doug and working with Doug on whatever we do with IT Garage, which is one of the sites that I do for Linux Journal. It was originally intended as a place where rank and file IT guys do creative stuff with technology, especially Linux, and it's open source, but doesn't have to be that, without using big vendors. Basically, it's a vendor independent kind of site, and so there's a, I'd like to do interviews while Doug and his friends do interviews with well-known people. I want to do it with unknown people or less-known people that are doing cool work inside of IT organizations. And so I want to use Doug's service to do that. I haven't done it yet, and I'm not sure how I'm going to do it, because he kind of likes the idea of having me and somebody else call in on the phone. And the ones that are two guys on a phone don't sound right to me. I think at least one guy needs to sound clean. And so I'm not sure how we're going to do that, but we have to work that one out. But I really love what Doug's done. I think Doug's a real hero of the revolution, as they say. And so are the people who work with him. He's got a kind of a volunteer organization there, and it's, yeah, he hasn't gone after the money, which is just wonderful. It makes it pure and really good. And it's kind of like public radio for podcasting. It's our public. It's the NPR of podcasting with a lot more integrity, I think.
Yeah. Going back to the Jabber and Google Talk discussion, have you used the Google Talk at all?
No, I haven't. If somebody was, I tried to get on the Linux box, I was trying to get do it from game over to somebody doing it on one of the Google, on their Google Gmail account. I did not have a Google Gmail account until yesterday. I got one finally. I was one of the first people offered one, but one of the last to actually get one. And I found that all versions of my name were long gone. And maybe I got one a long time ago and I didn't know it, and I just can't get back into it. But I wasn't able to make it work, and so I decided I'd do it today, and I haven't done it today. But I'm looking forward to see it happen. I'm assured that this can be done. So
I saw it done with game.
You've seen it. You've seen it done with game.
Yeah, because the Google Talk client is Windows only.
The talk line is. I know the talk line is Windows only, but I believe the text line is not. And the that you can do. As a matter of fact, somebody was talking to me on the Mac using iChat from their Google from their Google Gmail account using.
Well, you can log in using like Game, iChat. It supports Trillion and a couple other clients. I can't remember. But the actual Google Talk that has like the voice over IP and stuff built in,
right? That's all
just
Windows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's they're continuing.
Yeah.
The one thing that Chris said was that you guys have to realize that a lot of our apps we bought, like Picasa, we didn't do Google Earth, we didn't originally do Google Talk. It seems like they did from scratch, and it's still Windows only.
Yep. There was a friend of mine years ago had. When you walked into her office, she was a programmer, and she had three machines up. One was Linux, one was a Mac, and one was Windows. And I said, so how do you orient toward those? And she said, one was first in my head, one was first in my heart, and one was first out the door. And first out the door was Windows. And first in her heart was the Mac, and first in her head was Linux, because she was a Unix person.
Interesting.
Now that was enough years ago that was actually before Steve Jobs came back, and she was a Mac developer from way back and had been involved with Apple back in the early 80s, and so had a kind of affection there. I'm not sure people feel quite the same way toward them at this point. I mean, I certainly appreciate a lot of what Apple does, but there's a closed heart going on in there, and
speaking of the change of attitude, it seems like a lot of people are kind of turning on Google these days too.
There's a lot going on there, and part of it is as you and I did has to do with bristling at Google. Coming out with something first on Windows and not having any sign of coming out with something on other platforms. I mean, that's one thing. Another a really big thing right now is AdSense. I think while AdSense was an absolutely remarkable thing when it first came out, it's got some slummy qualities to it right now. There are a lot of really bad actors that are making money off of AdSense. And while Google knows that, they're not being conversational about it. I mean, I got a note today from somebody in response to my blog and saying, we are working on it, we're definitely doing stuff, and the people on the Blogger team are doing stuff. But Google bought Blogger, 2.5 years ago, and Blogger has hardly evolved since then. Now, Chris has pointed out to me, and others have, that they've moved they've put it on a much stronger infrastructure, and they've done a lot of back-end work on it that makes it much more reliable, and yada yada. But the world really could use some better blogging tools. I don't think, much as I love what Matt Mullenweg has done with WordPress, it's definitely a hacker's tool. I've got one for my podcast blog. My daughter has one. She's actually better at it than I am. But it's kind of opaque. It's definitely a hacky kind of thing. We need to make the web a good writing environment. Nobody's really done that. You always have to kind of go offline and pick your tool of choice and then port the text over. And it's not good. It's not been good for a long time. I think people want to look to Google as a company that will help us with that kind of stuff. But Google is also rather clearly, as Walt Mossberg pointed out in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago, they're definitely going after a lot of Microsoft's turf on the desktop, and it's on the Microsoft desktop, and that's obviously a mission for them. Now, of course, they're a big company, and when you say them, there are many thems there, and it's not fair to assume that they're all talking to each other and they're all working in one coordinated way.
It's kind of a bit myopic to try to fight a company by only releasing things on their platform in the end.
Well, I think it's certainly limited if it's not myopic. I mean, I think I would agree with that, but I'd also say that they need to support something more than the monoculture. I did a piece on IT Garage a few days ago about the monoculture that. There was a guy who wrote in who had a problem with his he just basically reached his wit's end with malware and viruses and so forth in an all Windows IT shop, and it was pretty clear to this guy that there wasn't an alternative for him to. I mean, he did not see Linux necessarily as an alternative. He lived inside that environment, and he was freaking out because he saw the day coming when the bad guys were going to be able to react faster than Microsoft was going to be able to react. And there would be an actual meltdown. And there would be something that's very much like what Jared Diamond talked about over and over again in his book called Collapse, which has been a bestseller this year, which reviews the collapses of many civilizations over time. And what we've got, in many cases, it would collapse because it was a monoculture of some sort. And that's what we have with Windows, and especially in IT. I don't think we have it as much out in the home marketplace. They're mostly thanks to Apple's success with iTunes and movies and making DVDs and stuff like that. Their market share of that kind of stuff is actually quite large, I understand. But they're, at least in the U.S. and certain European countries. But in much of the world, and especially in the business world, there is no alternative to Microsoft, especially on the desktop. And that's a very unhealthy condition. And Google is supporting that. There's no doubt about it. And when they make a decision to come out first on that platform, they're making a decision to further bias the, or if not outright pollute the environment. I think that it's a mistake, and I think that they have the advantage of time. They could be patient and come out with it as Firefox does, or the Mozilla Foundation does on multiple platforms, as those guys have done with Thunderbird and with
pretty much all their products.
With Firefox, all of it, yeah, and that to me is a responsible way to go. That gives the users choice. That means that the experience is going to be the same. It means that the plugin that you write is going to run across multiple platforms, and it could be that they just don't feel they can abstract things out. So the thing you work here is going to work over there. I don't know. I'm sure they have their reasons.
Do you think it'll change anytime soon?
I think it's going to change in time. That they have been more isolated than they used to be. Now maybe that's a perception on my part because I had a number of contacts there that left. I knew Wayne Rosing, who was the CTO, and he's gone, and especially Cindy McCaffrey, who is who ran marketing communications there. And there were any number of times when I could call her up or send her an email saying, hey, you guys have a problem here. There are a number of times, like, for example, when Google's search bots were crawling, say, the dynamic websites that were serving up pages dynamically a bit too aggressively. And Dave Weiner, for example, kind of, watched his servers melt down as Google's bots were aggressively crawling it, because they were looking for new stuff essentially constantly. And so I got in touch with Cindy and made sure that she got the right people in touch with Dave and with other people, and they worked it out. And that I used to feel like I could do that with Google, but I mean, like a week ago or 2 weeks ago, I don't know what it was, one of my PR contacts there, one of the PR guys that I know, I asked, I said, I'd like to talk to somebody about some AdSense stuff, and I did not hear anything back. I didn't hear anything until I posted this blog today.
Oh, okay.
It's they're now they're a bigger company, and they're that's just, you know, things happen, and you know, but I do believe they are involved in the marketplace, and in the long run, it is not in their interest to turn their backs on the open source community that they came from, essentially, and right. And I think that that's going to be the way it plays out in the long run.
One of the other things that I seem to be reading in the blogosphere quite a bit is that, you know, if you look at the sheer amount of data that they aggregate these days, because they know if you have the Google toolbar and, say, Google Desktop, and you use Google Talk and you use Google Maps, they know what you're searching for, who you're talking to, if you use Gmail, who you're emailing, you know, where you're going, potentially where you're coming from, where you're clicking if you have the toolbar installed. All that information aggregated could be dangerous. And to be honest, I don't think I worry about the Google of today. It's more, you know, if the government were to pressure them to do something, the amount of data that they do potentially have is probably more than any single entity's had in our lifetimes.
Well, yeah, that brings up a really important point. And this is something I wrote about in the current story in Linux Journal on identity, that there's an awful lot of data about ourselves, and that essentially belongs to us. Bank account information, for example. Transaction histories. Our transaction histories, say, with a hotel chain or with Starbucks or with a credit card company. That's, as far as I think any individual is concerned, that is their data. And any information about their shopping habits is essentially their data. And there's a kind of implicit quid pro quo understanding that it's also the retailer's data, or it's also the data of the credit card company. But as individuals have more access to that, or are going to assert the right to that over time, and I think through identity services, I think that's how it's going to happen, we're going to see business change radically, and we're going to see more activity like the Attention Trust. Steve Gilmore, who's a journalist fundamentally, and he's a former music producer, has came up with the idea of attention.xml that he worked on with the Technorati guys, which is now a published spec, and it allows us to share our attention data as we travel around the web, for example, on our terms. And there's the Attention Trust is an organization he just started very recently that has a number of laws about attention or statements of principle about attention, which basically says my attention is mine, my data about my attention is mine, and I share with others at my discretion and stuff like that. Now, that's going to, whatever Google's doing is going to have to square up with that. I think that in right now, and you know, Google's gone out of its way to not be intrusive about that, and to basically test out the theory, and it's only a theory as far as I'm concerned, but it is a holy grail of advertising, that there is a class of advertising that users will actually value, that will actually add value rather than subtract value. The problem with blog spam right now is that there's a lot of advertising that outright subtracts value in an environment that was designed to make it provide value. And that's because spam blogs are blogs that, in Mark Cuban's terms, and it was very observant of him to say this, are don't add value. That's how you define them. They're blogs that don't add value.
They take away value because they subtract value.
But at the very least, you could say that they're, you know, if you or I or a kid or anybody we know starts a blog, there's the assumption that they're going to try to add value in the world. That's not what's happening with these spam blogs. And, you know, there's some interesting background noise going on out there. I don't know what that is. Anyway.
Well, I read that Ice Rocket's considering kicking Blogspot, which is one of the blogger domains, right out of the engine.
Yeah, I think that's bluster. I think that would be very value subtractive on their part. There are too many Blogspot bloggers that are legitimate that would get really pissed off. But maybe not. I know that there are some blog search engines that, for example, quarantine any .info site. Something like 98% of all .info sites are bogus, apparently.
Yeah.
That's And so it's a, and obviously it's a good bet that if a .info site comes your way, it's a bogus site. But that's a better call, I think, than Blogspot. I mean, there are lots and lots of Blogspot sites that would be cheated for Ice Rocket. I mean, I think Ice Rocket would be shooting itself in the foot if they did that. It would be a PR move. It'd be a little muscle move against Google. But this is a big thing that's going to come. That's definitely a major PR problem that Google has right now. And I'm glad to hear from people on the inside that they're dealing with it. I'd like to see them more, deal with it more publicly, and I'd like to see them do it with other search engines. Now, so, you know, one guy I know suggested that you know, Google's not motivated to do that because from, I mean, I said in my blog that splogs, what Mark Cuban calls splogs, are the spam blogs are a cancer on the blogosphere. They're a cancer on what I call the live web, which
I
is
would
the,
definitely
you know,
agree
the,
with that.
Yeah, and they're a cancer. But from what this guy, you know, one guy wrote to me and said, well, you know what, from Google's perspective, the blog search engines are the cancer, and the spam blogs are the chemo, and because they're going to kill the technorates and feedsters of the world before they'll kill a Google, and that's, I'm sure that's not what Google has in mind, but the fact that somebody would make that interpretation, I think, is indicative of the vast differences between the kind of search that the two groups do. I mean, I think that Google and Yahoo and MSN Search and A9 and all the traditional search engines are made to search the static web. That's not the syndicated web. And what Technorati and Feedster and Bloglines and Blogpulse and Ice Rocket search is the live web. It's one that's about people and time. It's not about structures. I mean, the way we describe the static web is very much in real estate terms, and it's in construction terms. You say a site is under construction and has an address with a location, right? And you hire a design firm, you know, to architect your site and build it for you and that kind of shit. And that's I'm not knocking that, but that's the original understanding of the web. That's how it was designed in the first place. And
sure.
Not designed, it was the way it was implemented in the first place. I shouldn't say that's the way it was designed, because Tim Berners-Lee, in fact, wanted the writable web that Dave Winer wanted as well, right? That the web is a pile of documents, not necessarily a pile of locations. And although we mix those metaphors, and that's a fine thing to do, we mix metaphors all the time. But the journalistic metaphor, the one where you have periodical publications that have an implicit schema that is chronological, the way the net was designed in the first place, and that the web is designed as well, was that you're looking essentially at a Unix path where only the top level is defined, and you've got two slashes and a name, and everything to the right of that, all the paths that go off to the right of that are undefined. There's no directory there. There's only DNS doesn't care about that. DNS only cares about the top level. So it's all chaos to the right. So Google and the static web search engines look at that chaos and say, we can help you find a haystack, a needle in this haystack. It is a haystack, and we'll help you find a needle in it. And we've all become accustomed to thinking of that as a haystack. Well, along come the blog search engines that are searching the live web, and they're saying, wait a minute, there is in fact an implicit, there is an implicit data structure to this. There is, in fact, a directory structure to this that is, of all the ways you can organize it, this one. It's chronological. You go to the right of the domain name, and you've got literally year, month, day, post, and that post is called a permalink. Now, not every blog system lays those out in the same way, but that is, in fact, the way that we understand it. And it's conceivable in the long run to say that a service like Technorati could say, you know, you want to find, you know, what Jeremy wrote on December 12th, 2004, here it is. Because we know that chronology. We can go back and find that in that chronology.
Far enough out into the future, don't the line between the live web and the static web get blurred sufficiently that they become kind of one and the same?
Well, I think that line is blurred right now, what the live, I mean, they are all one thing. I mean, it's a very blurred line, and I think it's in Google's interest and Yahoo's interest to keep that line as blurred as possible, and it's in the interest of Technorati and Feedster and Bloglines to make that line as sharp as possible and say, they do that, we do this. You know, that's
right.
And it's pretty interesting. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can look up where the results are radically different between them. There's one that I enjoyed looking at a few months ago that a friend of mine showed me who's used to be involved in the fashion business and had a friend who worked for Victoria's Secret. And Victoria's Secret had come out with a new bra called IPEX. I think it's IPEX. And if you looked it up on Google or Yahoo, you got the Victoria's Secret site and you got several other brochure-type static sites as the top results. And if you looked it up on Technorati, what you got was lots and lots of women talking about that bra and on their blogs, going back and forth.
Right.
And it was an astonishing thing to show the people at Victoria's Secret because it showed what their customers were actually saying about that bra rather than what some focus group would say. And it was honest and it was clear and it was extraordinarily useful information. And this
That's
is
information
in fact,
they
I
would
feel
have typically
right now,
paid huge money
tried
for.
To look this up. What's that?
That's information they would have typically paid huge money for.
Exactly. And now it's free. And it's a remarkable thing. And Google's not providing that. This is a hole in Google's service. And it's a hole in Yahoo's service. And Yahoo will say they're searching and MSN will say they're searching it, but they're not searching it as diligently as these other guys are. These other guys are the ones that are moving search forward there. And you know, that's one of the reasons I get upset the other day, Jason Kotke, who's a great guy and who I like a great deal, crapped all over Technorati, said goodbye to Technorati because Technorati's service was, you know, down a lot, which I know for a fact it wasn't down as much as he said it was, but that it had, you know, that it was, you know, it had a lot of spam in it and had all these problems and screw it and I'm going somewhere else. Well, you know, they're pioneers. You know, they're not Google. You know, Google had, you know, God knows how much venture capital to play with for many years before they had a business model. I think there were 10,000 servers before they came out with AdSense and AdWords and started making money. And the right. likes of Technorati and Feedster and the rest of those didn't have that. Now, Bloglines has been bought by Ask Jeeves, but the rest of them are still out there doing pioneering on their own and in an area where you know, Google's not taking a lead, and where these other guys are not taking a lead.
So Yahoo claims to search RSS now, correct?
I can't see it. You know,
I
go there, look, I don't see it. I mean, if they're doing it, it's not a visible thing. They had a site up briefly that was an RSS search site, and somebody discovered it, and they made it invisible again.
They're
working on something.
That was the one I was talking about.
Yeah.
And Google doesn't even claim to, correct? So do you think they'll go buy a company like Technorati?
But there were rumors for a while that Google was going to come out with one, but and I've heard from various people that they've had the capability for a long time, but I don't see the interest and I don't think it's their thing. And I don't want it to be their thing at this point. I really think it's very important to have these other pioneers out there doing the pioneering work. I mean, let Google be conservative and lay back and come at it later. And let these other guys at least have a chance at succeeding before the likes of Google comes in and flattens them. If RSS search were left up to Google or if, you know, these other companies go out of business, the world is going to be a worse place for that. I think we need, you know, we need a polyculture. We don't need a monoculture here.
Sure. So. And on the subject of syndication, Nielsen just released a report. I think they polled like 1,000 blog readers, which admittedly is probably way too small a sample size to be useful. But it said 66% of them had either never heard of or didn't understand RSS. 23% claimed that they understood it but never used it, which means almost 90%. Of the people that read blogs have never used RSS, which I found surprising.
I think I'm sure that that had a lot to do with the way the questions were asked. I mean, if you go out and ask people, you know, what do you understand about RF transmission? They'll say, I don't know what that is. And they have a radio in their car, and they use the radio in the car. It's almost impossible for somebody to search the web and not run across a weblog. That said, however, I think that RSS is still new. I think that the, you know, it doesn't matter that there are 14 million blogs. Probably if you subtract the spammers, you come down to about, 10 million. But still, it's a lot. It's still a very, very small number compared to all the people that are using computers that are connected to the net. It's a matter of time, I think, before blogs and related life forms are the majority of pages on the web. I think it's just like, you know, people.
Well, this said that they polled 1,000 regular blog readers, as in people who regularly read blogs, which I can't see regularly going to a blog and never hurting RSS. There's RSS buttons on almost every blog.
Well, a lot of the buttons are orange buttons that say XML.
And
people look at that and they don't know what that is. Or there's a sign that says syndicate this or subscribe to this, and they
or
may
web
subscribe
feeds
to
now.
And not know that that's RSS. It's not obvious to a lot of people. I don't think it's an issue. I think it's just, you know, it's just another research company saying some shit and doesn't really mean anything.
Okay. Getting to, I don't like the shows to go much over an hour and a half, so I'll maybe cover one more, and then
okay.
This, like I said, this is the interview series, and then we also do a live show that has a panel, typically four of us, so it'd be great to have you back on that, you know, pretty much whenever you want.
Yeah, I'd love to.
So let me pick one more. What do you think of the recent action of Linus and the Linux Mark, Institute, I think it is, going after and asking for money for trademarking Linux?
You know what? I don't know anything about it. So I suppose I should know something about it, but I really don't know.
Basically, they started in Australia first, and they contacted about 90 companies. And basically, if you use – it was Linux in your name, not if you use Linux or anything like that. But so if your name was Linux Foo Company, you'd have to pay in between, I think it was $200. And if your revenue is over $1 million a year, it was like $2,000 a year to basically to license the Linux mark. But they haven't done it in the U.S. yet.
Was Linus involved in that, or is he fighting that?
No, he was involved in him and Mad Dog, and I forget if it's Linux Mark. Basically, when Linus trademarked the name, he set up a. I should have wrote the name of it down now, and I didn't. But they're saying it's to protect the name of Linux, so that if you're doing something like shady, or basically if you're not up to a certain standard, you can still use Linux. You can still do whatever you want with it. You just can't have it in your company name.
Yeah. You know what? I don't know anything about it. But interesting, an interesting point though, and this is one that Craig Burton made a number of years ago. Is that he said that everybody is proprietary essentially about something. I mean, even Richard Stallman is proprietary about the GPL in a certain way. I mean, he's sort of the keeper of the correct thinking on that subject, right? A point that Craig made was that Linux, in a certain way, is proprietary. It's proprietary because there's this little trademark, this little line that says Linux is a registered trademark of Linus Torvalds, or whatever it is that it says. I think it says that. And so that's where he's proprietary. You know, I guess that's what that's saying. And if he wants to be proprietary about that in his way, I'm not sure that's a big deal. I think as big deals go, the BitKeeper fiasco is probably a much bigger deal than that one was. That was a case where a lot of people got to say, "I told you so."
A lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of people.
That was an interesting one.
Yeah, yeah. But it's a live and learn thing. You know, I mean, being human is being wrong about a lot of things. You know, that's one of the things I actually like about blogging and podcasting, that we, you know, what we say is inherently provisional. It's not, I know when I write for Linux Journal, for example, or if I'm writing a column for somebody, and you know, if I'm giving a speech that's has a degree of importance to it, I'm standing behind the podium, there's this pontifical voice that I have to take on, and there's a level of certitude that I have to feel comfortable about having before I speak. I can't take chances that the thing I say might be wrong. That's what we have with blogging and podcasting. I can, you know, I can say, well, this guy says that, you know, this and that about Google or Technorati or something, and I think that might be true, or I think it's got some credibility to it. That's okay. I think you still have to be responsible about it and disclaim it in certain ways and disclose certain things, but on the whole, there's a lot more leeway there. And so, anyway, I forgot where that point started, but I felt like making it.
Oh, it's the Linux Mark Institute. So its companies will need to pay between $200 and $5,000 to sublicense the Linux trademark. Recently made a post to the Linux kernel mailing list kind of clarifying it, because people were taking it kind of the completely wrong way at first, that they thought they were actually
the Linux
licensing
kernel
like Linux. Yeah, correct.
Yeah, yeah. You know what?
So that must not have made as much news as...
My head has been under a rock on that one, that's for sure.
So all right,
I sit exposed on that one.
I'll send you a link to it.
Okay, great.
So I'll wrap that up here. I really appreciate you being on the show, and like I said, I definitely like to get you on the actual show as opposed to just the interview series. So.
Okay, great. Well, I appreciate it too.
All right, talk to you later.
And look forward to hearing whatever it was that we said.
Great. I'll send you the link to that too.
Okay.
All right, thanks, Doc.